dweller holding the biggest oil reserves in the world. That's right. Iran coming in at number three, along with their other allies such as Russia and China, creating dominance and a bloc in the oil market. The U.S. should be worried.
On June 11, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro visited the Islamic Republic of Iran. Maduro, who headed a high-ranking delegation, held talks with top Iranian officials. But the highlight of his visit was the signing of a 20-year cooperation agreement between Iran and Venezuela. The partnership agreement includes cooperation in the fields of science, technology, agriculture, oil and gas, petrochemicals, tourism, as well as culture. The delegations from both countries discussed details of the future cooperation as the leaders focused on issues of mutual cooperation on economic issues.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
During Maduro's visit to Tehran, Venezuela took delivery of a second Aframax-sized oil tanker manufactured by Iran's Sadra Shipbuilding Company, under a contract signed between Iran and Venezuela more than a decade ago. Sadra will deliver two more such tankers, with a price tag of over 16 million euros for each tanker, to Venezuela within the next years. Iran and Venezuela have developed close economic and political ties in recent years as they seek to counter American sanctions targeting their energy sectors.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Venezuela and Iran, two countries united by a common vision regarding international issues, and victims of coercive measures by the United States and its allies, have had diplomatic ties for more than 60 years. But mutual relations became strategic with the arrival of the late commander Hugo Chavez to power in Venezuela back in the year 1999.
It was very interesting how the Western media labeled this visit by the Venezuelan president to Iran as to how two sanctioned countries, who in their eyes are suffering economically, can actually help each other out. And it was more surprising to see how many have failed to realize that a new world order is actually taking shape, this shift which includes a financial one. Nevertheless, these are some of the online posts that we picked out for you for this segment. First, Iran and Venezuela signed 20-year partnership agreement to bolster ties. Quote, Venezuela and Iran have a common goal of fighting colonialism and imperialism across the globe, according to Nicolas Maduro. Now, the next post, Iran and Venezuela have closer ties with each other than any other country. The Islamic Republic of Iran has proven that when dangers arise for its friends, Iran takes risks and helps its friends. The next post, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro visited Iran and signed a historic 20-year cooperation agreement involving energy, technology, and trade. He pledged support against Western aggression in a joint anti-imperialist struggle for a better world. Then we picked out this post, 113,000-ton tanker built by Iran for Venezuela, boosting ties on oil and U.S. sanctions. Take a look. Okay, joining us for this segment of the Q&A is Jesus Rodriguez Espinoza. He is a political, international affairs, and independent media analyst. He's also the founder and editor at Sign of OrinocoTribune.com. And he's also a former diplomat, consul general at the Consulate of Venezuela in Chicago. And he joins us from Caracas, Venezuela. Very well. Thanks for joining us here on Economic Divide, Mr. Rodriguez Espinoza. Taking a look at the fact that the Venezuelan president has visited Iran, obviously a very important pact was signed, 20 years in duration. These are two oil-producing giants. The plan includes cooperation in the oil sector. What is the significance of this, given that both countries are under heavy U.S. sanctions?
Yes. The relationship between Venezuela and Iran, I could call it like a life or death strategic relationship currently. So these agreements, these meetings that President Maduro had with the highest authorities of Iran are, in my opinion, like a natural consequence of the level of strategic relations between Venezuela and Iran. So an important thing that I was not aware of was the delivery of this oil tanker Yoraco that was built in Iran, and it's the second one that Iran have delivered to Venezuela. It's a 800,000 barrels of oil tanker, which shows the economic strength of Iran, the economic might of Iran. Building that kind of, tankers is something that can only be done by countries that are really advancing in industrializing, in strengthening their economy.
All right, so let's bring in Arnold August. He is a Montreal-based journalist and a contributing editor for the Canada Files, who joins us. Arnold August, welcome. You have these two energy powerhouses who have met and have forged ties with this 20-year agreement. Iran also has agreements like with Russia, another 20-year agreement, China, 25-year agreement. We're looking at Saudi Arabia thinking of doing some oil deals in the yuan. What I'm trying to get at is you have all these factors that are leaving the U.S. out. What kind of impression does that give of the U.S., or on the U.S., given that many are saying that it's weakening in the world stage?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think it was really, interesting and inspiring, I may say, is when at the very time when the United States was trying to impose its hegemony over Latin America through its so-called Summit of the Americas by excluding countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, you have President Maduro visiting Iran and other countries in Eurasia in order to further develop the ties between Venezuela and these countries. And so I think it's extremely important. And of course, part of this whole thing is this new deal that you mentioned with regards to Saudi Arabia. Now, talking about traveling, Biden has to go to Saudi Arabia, I think, in a week or two. He's supposed to go there in order to try to improve the relationship with Saudi Arabia. So on the one hand, you have Saudi Arabia very well developing ties very well with Iran. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia has been rather defensive with regards to the United States as a result of the Ukraine-Russia crisis and the sanctions against Russia. To the extent when Biden calls Saudi Arabia in order, I guess, to try to get them to produce more oil for the United States at reasonable prices, the Saudi Arabian government did not even respond to Biden. So he's going there, I guess, begging for Saudi Arabia to try to help the United States get out of this quagmire.
It's time now for our Info News section, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first stop, anti-Iran U.S. sanctions. That's right, U.S. has targeted Chinese and UAE companies, and these are new Iran sanctions that have taken place. Well, U.S. officials are saying that absent return to the nuclear deal, which entails the Vienna talks, Washington will use sanctions to limit what they say Iranian petrochemical exports. And this obviously does not fall in line with their previous claims that the maximum pressure policy on Iran has actually failed. So that is another notch in the wrong approach by the U.S. when it comes to the Islamic Republic. Next up, Revlon bankruptcy. That's right, Revlon, the big cosmetics manufacturer, has filed for bankruptcy. Now, the company lost shelf space in U.S. stores to basically startups that were backed by celebrities. That was big. And it also is struggling with inflation and supply chain issues, which have plagued many companies headquartered in the U.S. or around the world. Moving on now to the Russian President Vladimir Putin's speech. That was a big deal, and where he said that the old world order is over. He said that new centers of power have emerged. The unipolar world order is not coming back, and the colonial way of thinking has actually failed. In an extension of some of the things that he said, the Western economic damage to be very severe. That's another angle that we are presenting here for InfoNews section. Moscow identifying the cause of global economic woes, where Putin said loose fiscal policy, money printing, is the cause of inflation, not what is happening in Ukraine, not the military operation that Russia is executing there. Those were some of the topics that we picked for our InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Anti-imperialist resistance. That is the underlying theme for our in-depth section. The U.S. and many Western countries have forced countries that have hegemonic tendencies, like the U.S., to devise their own means of creating an economic order that perseveres through illegal U.S. sanctions. Venezuela and Iran are one good example of that. Let's take a look at the moves that Iran has made in terms of agreements. We're taking a look at, first, the 20-year agreement that Venezuela and Iran have signed. Just one in a string of agreements that Iran has signed with major powers. Obviously, the 20-year agreement that Iran signed with Venezuela is of significant importance because these are two major oil producers. Now, similar to the 20-year agreement that Iran signed with Venezuela, Iran has also signed a 20-year agreement with Russia. Obviously, Russia, again, another major oil producer, but in the sphere of security and also trade blocs, this is very important, the agreement signed between Iran and Russia. Then comes the Iran-China 25-year agreement. That is obvious in terms of the importance that has. Obviously, China is a major economic powerhouse that both are going to benefit in many respects. Obviously, again, Iran being a major oil producer in terms of the supply it can provide for China. Now, Iran has signed many other agreements that are not as long in duration. Countries like Nicaragua, for example, and even Pakistan. The trade involves ways to exchange products without the need of the U.S.-dominated financial system, thus circumventing Washington's unilateral sanctions, which are illegal under international law. Now, since we have Venezuela as a focus here, it is noteworthy to point out that there is a tectonic shift that is taking place in Latin America. Now, here are some of the leaders that have left-leaning tendencies, these politicians, many of whom are against the U.S. imperialistic approach. After all, they have not reaped the benefits of the Western financial system and want to shift their trade to other countries that are independent of U.S. foreign policy. And these are some of the leaders that have opted to do that, the Cuban presidents, Nicaraguan presidents, and Lula Ignacio da Silva we put in there because he may be the future president of Brazil based on many projections. Now, one of the most interesting things to come out of this union of Venezuela and Iran is the share of the global oil market. Here are the top oil producers in the world: Russia, Saudi Arabia, United States, and it goes on down the list. The importance here is the fact that these oil producers, many of them are not happy with the U.S., and their relationship with the U.S. has either cooled off or is changing or evolving away from the U.S. I mean, countries like Saudi Arabia, China, the UAE, even OPEC-producing countries, and of course Venezuela, these are countries that are not as close to the U.S. anymore. Now, in the case of Venezuela, it has the largest oil reserves in the world. Projection is 303 billion barrels. Now, Iran has 157 billion barrels, and Russia with 89 billion barrels of crude. These are the reserves. Now, when you put that all together, this equals 45% of the world reserves. And this represents a huge potential for influencing the world market. Okay? So that's where the significance of the union of these countries, Iran, Russia, and Venezuela, for example, comes in. Let's bring back Jesus Rodriguez Espinoza, who's a political at International Affairs and Independent Media Analyst, joining us. Jesus Rodriguez Espinoza, welcome back. You have these two energy powerhouses forging ties, Iran and Venezuela. And, of course, you have Iran's ties with Russia, the agreement that it has with that country, and then the 25-year agreement with China. Saudi Arabia thinking of doing some of its oil deals in the yuan. Doesn't all this point out to not only energy producers unifying, but also how the U.S. is weakening on the world stage?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the U.S., even before this Ukrainian conflict, has been showing not only the U.S., the U.S., Europe, and the most industrialized countries from the West, as they call them, has been showing signs of cracks for several years already. I mean, we are talking about during the pandemic, for example, all those disruptions in the distribution chain, in the production chain, in industrial countries show us that something wrong was happening there.
All right, let's bring back Arnold August. He's a Montreal-based journalist and the contributing editor for the Canada Files. Arnold August, welcome back. Iran's president has said the Islamic Republic of Iran has always sought relations with independent countries in its foreign policy. Venezuela has resisted the sanctions of the enemies and imperialism and has shown exemplary resistance. So when you take a look at that and the trade that's going to be done between the two countries, isn't Iran the one that can teach Venezuela how to circumvent these U.S. sanctions, something that Iran has been doing for decades at this point?
Yes, I think that is one of the many features that solidify the relationship, long-term relationship between the two countries. I guess it's sort of a quirk of history or geography or whatever that Iran is blessed with condensate oil, which is needed by Venezuela in order to thin its very thick oil that is produced in that country. So as a result of this, geopolitical accident, I guess you can say, and in defiance of sanctions against Venezuela by the United States, the Islamic Republic carried out, in my view, a very heroic gesture in 2020, a short while ago, by sending several tankers from Iran to Venezuela to provide them with this condensate, which is very important to develop the production of oil in that country.
Iran and Venezuela share mutual concerns as both nations are under U.S. sanctions. The partnership between the two oil-rich nations aims to counter U.S. hegemonic and imperialist interventionist policies. Iran is helping Venezuela with the repair and maintenance of its oil facilities. Iran has supplied fuel shipments and equipment needed in crude refineries to Venezuela in the face of U.S. pressure on the country's shipping and trade services. Venezuela has also received major shipments of condensate, a diluent of heavy oil from Iran. Venezuela had doubled its oil production thanks to Iran's help in defiance of U.S. sanctions against Caracas. Venezuelan oil experts confirmed the significant growth in the country's production, underlining that the Iranian naphtha is essential for the government in Caracas to be able to sell crude from the Orinoco oil belt, which needs to be diluted to be sold on world markets. Within the framework of the Tehran-Caracas Strategic Alliance, Iran sent five tankers loaded with 1.53 million barrels of gasoline and additives to Venezuela in May 2020 to supply the South American nation, which was mired in severe fuel shortages as a result of sanctions.
When it comes to the topic of imperialism, there are obvious countries that come to mind: the UK, France, and the US. But what is most talked about nowadays is how the U.S. is falling from its superpower status. That is something that is understood worldwide. Even U.S. allies like the U.K. have said that. Like the U.K. Defense Secretary, who said a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power. Why does this matter? Because the fall or decline of a country from the superpower status means that economically it has to decline in order for that to happen. And that is something that has been happening for quite some time. Here's a map of the world. Notice that the countries that the U.S. is a member of a trading bloc. Then compare that to the rest of the world. It is pretty evident that the U.S. is not a member of many trading blocs. Then comes the issue of sanctions. The U.S. has been using sanctions as a weapon. You may have heard the term weaponization of the dollar. These are some of the countries that the U.S. has currently placed under U.S. sanctions. There are 20 countries in total, according to the U.S. Treasury Department. Many of these countries have said enough is enough and have allied themselves with other sanctioned countries. Obviously, Iran and Venezuela are two of those countries. Not only does the efficacy or inefficiency of sanctions come into play, there's also another result. Sanctioned countries get closer together and do trade. And that is part of the new world order, since countries don't have faith in the U.S. like they used to. This is what countries in West Asia are saying. Our Mideast partners have lost confidence in America's commitment to global leadership or competence for it following last year's botched Afghanistan withdrawal. The Middle Eastern countries have no interest in abandoning relations with China, the leading trading partner for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, or breaking with Russia. And that includes Iran and Venezuela, who have forged ties and are gravitating to doing business with countries away from the long arm of U.S. sanctions, spelling the new world order. That does it for this section of the program.
The world is no longer dominated by the U.S. and some Western countries. That is what is unfolding as we speak. Now, just this week, Iran has hosted five officials and dignitaries. Officials from Venezuela, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Pakistan, Azerbaijan. Wait a minute, that's six dignitaries. Anyways, all these countries means trade and economic gains and sales. And all these countries are aligned with Russia and China and other countries who don't want to be pulled into U.S. military quagmires or to be pressured under U.S. foreign policy. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. It was great having you with us. We would really appreciate it if you send us your comments and questions. For Mika Vitakvai, looking forward to seeing you next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Gun enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning, not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. The article you're about to hear has been written by Nicholas Kristof, a former New York Times opinion columnist. Nicholas Kristof was a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of Oregon this year. The piece is titled, "These Gun Reforms Could Save 15,000 Lives. We Can Achieve Them." Enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning and not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. But we're tired of commemorating gun violence in America only with thoughts and prayers. We didn't respond to the 9/11 attacks only with moments of silence, or to Pearl Harbor just with lowered flags and memorial services. No, we resolved to act, even though these were hard challenges with no perfect solutions. Gun policy is likewise complicated and politically vexing, and we're not going to make everyone safe. Still, experts suggest that over time, we plausibly could reduce gun deaths by a third, or 15,000 lives saved annually, with a series of pragmatic limits on firearms and those who can get them. Instead, we're paralyzed in ways that threaten our democracy and our well-being. American children and American teenagers are 57% more likely to die young compared with children and teenagers in other advanced countries. And guns are one important reason. One study found that Americans aged between 15 and 19 are 82 times more likely to be shot dead than similarly aged teenagers in our peer countries. Let's just acknowledge that what we're doing isn't working, and we need new approaches. So what's a way forward? This will be painful for many of my fellow liberals, but I suggest that we work harder to engage centrists, talk about gun safety rather than gun control, and jump into the weeds. Social scientists suggest complexifying an issue to reduce polarization, and sure enough, I find that I can sometimes have productive conversations with gun enthusiasts if we focus on technocratic details. For example, consider the minimum age to buy or possess a gun. The suspects in both the Uvalde, Texas and Buffalo, New York shootings were only 18 years old, and that's not surprising. Americans aged between 18 and 20 account for 4% of the population, but 17% of those known to have committed a murder. In Wyoming, one of the most pro-gun states in America, the minimum age to buy a handgun is 21. Overall, one-third of states limit purchase of a handgun to those who are age 21 or older, according to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. If we say that teenagers can't buy alcoholic drinks, isn't it worth having a conversation about whether they should be able to buy Glock 19 handguns and AR-15-style rifles? One study found that 17% of all firearm offenders obtained guns legally, but would not have been able to do so if their state required handgun purchases to be at least 21. Even more would have been ineligible to buy guns if there had been limits imposed on those with drug and alcohol convictions. That's another conversation to have. We typically don't allow people with felony convictions to possess firearms. And wouldn't it also make sense to bar purchases by someone with a recent misdemeanor conviction for drug or alcohol abuse, for violence, or for stalking? Only 10 states bar people with stalking convictions from buying guns. We know that people going through breakups are particularly at risk to themselves and to their ex-partners. So why not pass red flag laws that allow guns to be removed from someone who is undergoing a mental health crisis or subject to a domestic violence protection order? Even former President Donald Trump has backed red flag laws. What about universal background checks to buy a firearm? Opinion polls suggest that gun owners themselves overwhelmingly favor universal background checks. Yet 22% of firearms are obtained without them. In much of America, there is a more thorough review of people adopting a rescue dog than of those buying assault rifles. And should we really continue to allow people on the no-fly list to buy firearms but not board a plane. These are pragmatic steps that won't eliminate gun violence or avert every shooting incident, but they can make our country a bit safer. And while they will feel flimsy and unsatisfactory to many, they would at least break the paralysis on sensible gun policy. They would indicate that some progress is possible at a time when gun-related deaths have been worsening. Nineteen elementary school children died in the Texas school shooting on Tuesday, 24th of May, along with two teachers. 9 days earlier, six people were shot in a California church, one fatally, and five were shot, two fatally, at a Texas flea market. A day before that, a gunman killed 10 people in a racist attack on black shoppers in Buffalo, New York. When New Zealand experienced a mass shooting in 2019, that country acted in just 26 days to tighten gun laws. But here in America, it has been 56 years since one of the first gun massacres, the University of Texas Tower shooting in 1966, that claimed the lives of 17 people. Yet we know that gun safety is not a hopeless task, because just about every other country manages to do better. The Onion's satirical website regularly responds to mass shootings with the headline, "No way to prevent this," says only nation where this regularly happens. It has a point. The result of our paralysis is that just since 1975, more Americans have died from guns, including suicides, murders, and accidents, than in all the wars in United States history, going back to the American Revolution. Is the Second Amendment an obstacle? Perhaps to some degree. But most of us, judges included, recognize that we need some limits on weapons. Few believe that private citizens should be able to possess mortars, or that it's okay for 15-year-old teenagers to buy assault rifles. The practical question is a difficult one of where precisely to draw the lines. The truth is that we're not going to ban guns in the United States any more than we're going to ban alcohol, motorcycles, hunting knives, cigarettes, or other products that can be deadly. Screaming maximalist fights about gun control versus the Second Amendment have created a political stalemate as we continue to lose 45,000 lives a year to gun violence. That's 123 lives lost in a single day. This does not happen in other countries. Japan typically loses a single-digit number of people to gun murders in a year. We lost twice that in a single school shooting incident on Tuesday. Whenever I write about guns, I get indignant protests. Cars kill about as many Americans a year as guns do, but you don't ban cars. No, but we do work to make vehicles safer. Auto safety is a boring, non-politicized endeavor driven by engineers that has enabled us to live with dangerous objects, that is cars, and reduce the auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by more than 90% of the population since 1923. Likewise, we have a non-politicized safety process for ladders, swimming pools and toys. 8 pages of federal regulations on ladders, which kill around 100 people a year, with safety campaigns including making March Ladder Safety Month. Why can't we take a similar evidence-based approach to guns, not aiming for mass confiscation, but for reducing the carnage? For example, we require a license to operate a car, so why not a license to buy a gun? That's the law in Massachusetts, which has one of the lowest gun mortality rates in America. And while Massachusetts is a liberal state where one might expect tighter gun laws, Permits are also required through a simpler process to buy a handgun in North Carolina. Texas had such a requirement, but last year approved a new law ending the mandate for a license to carry a handgun. Addressing gun violence must also include a strong mental health component, as the military recognizes in its strategy to reduce suicides. Likewise, social programs like Cure Violence and Becoming a Man aren't specifically about guns, but do appear to reduce gun violence. There are many other steps that we can take. Safe storage requirements for firearms keep guns from children and thieves. Some 380,000 guns are stolen annually from private owners in the United States. We need to crack down on ghost guns assembled by the purchaser from parts without a serial number or any background checks. We must curb the next technology, firearms made by 3D printers. Let's be driven by evidence, which means more research. What about voluntary gun buybacks to reduce the pool of 400 million guns already in America? What about warning labels and guns, cautioning that a firearm in the house increases the risk of a gun death? What about a tax on guns to cover some of the external costs of their misuse, just as we tax cigarettes? What about universal background checks to buy ammunition? How about waiting periods or a limit of 2 gun purchases a month per person? How about a crackdown on straw purchasers who equip gangs? America is losing ground to guns. An estimated 18.8 million firearms were sold in the United States last year. The United States already has the highest number of firearms per capita by far. Yemen, in the midst of a civil war, ranks second. American civilians appear to have more assault weapons, the civilian versions, than the United States military has of the automatic version. So spare us the pious calls to avoid politics. Rather, let's supplement thoughts and prayers with concrete steps based on nerdy evidence gathering, based on hard conversations with people we disagree with to reduce gun deaths so that elementary schools need not be graveyards.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. No other person in the country was capable of pulling this off. We know political and seminarian personalities, some from close up and some from a distance. No person was capable of carrying that heavy load and bringing it to the destination. That endeavor was exclusive to our magnanimous Imam. It was he who managed to accomplish that feat. At different stages, Imam even pointed the various arenas of fighting. He showed the people where the arena of fighting was. He did so in different periods of time, and in line with the developments of the time. During the time of revolutionary activities, headed it in one way, and in the heat of bloody days leading to the victory of the revolution, he did it in another way. When the regime was thinking of imposing martial law in its last breaths, of sending the people home, and of pulling out the root by the absence of the people, Imam called on the people to pour onto the streets with divine inspiration. It was really divine inspiration, and Imam himself said it later on.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In those hours, many revolutionary politicians opposed to this. They said that was dangerous for Imam. Imam, however, said no, and he asked the people to take to the streets. This was an effort to determine the arena of fighting. That is, it became clear that in those hours and on that day, the arena of fighting was for the people to take to the streets. He would determine the arena of fighting like this. In the first months after the revolution, he determined what the arena of fighting was. In the second month, the arena was to carry out a referendum and to choose the political system and to confront anti-revolutionary forces. At some point, the issue of power came up, during which the revolutionary and fighting forces of the revolution were besieged. Imam ordered everyone to go and participate. I'd not forget that hour. And that day, Tehran had taken on a particular atmosphere. It seemed that everyone on the streets wanted to go to Pavé. They were looking for a car or any other means to make it to Pavé on the orders of Imam. So he would show where the arena of fighting was.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Through its
agencies, the U.S. government, regularly plants fake news and false information. Therefore, social media hiring individuals straight from the FBI, CIA, NATO, and other groups to work on regulating disinformation is a fundamentally flawed practice. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading The Federal Bureau of Tweets. Twitter is hiring an alarming number of FBI agents. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Twitter has been on a recruitment drive of late, hiring a host of former feds and spies. Studying a number of employment and recruitment websites, Mint Press has ascertained that the social media giant has, in recent years, recruited dozens of individuals from the national security state to work in the fields of security, trust, safety, and content. Chief amongst these is the Federal Bureau of Investigations. The FBI is generally known as a domestic security and intelligence force. However, it has recently expanded its remit into cyberspace. The FBI's investigative authority is the broadcast of all federal law enforcement agencies. The About section of its website informs the readers. It adds, the FBI has divided its investigations into a number of programs, such as domestic and international terrorism, foreign counterintelligence, and cybercrime. For example, in 2019, Don Burton, the former director of Washington operations for Lockheed Martin, was poached from her job as senior innovation advisor to the director at the FBI to become senior director of strategy and operations for legal, public policy, trust, and safety at Twitter. The following year, Karen Walsh went straight from 21 years at the Bureau to become Director of Corporate Resilience at the Silicon Valley giant. Twitter's Deputy General Counsel and Vice President of Legal, Jim Packer, also spent 4 years at the FBI between 2014 and 2018, where his resume notes he rose to the role of senior strategic advisor. Meanwhile, Mark Jaroszewski ended his 21-year posting as a supervisory special agent in the Bay Area to take up a position at Twitter, rising to become Director of Corporate Security and Risk. And Douglas Turner spent 14 years as a senior special agent and SWAT team leader before being recruited to serve in Twitter's corporate and executive security services. Previously, Turner had also spent 7 years as a Secret Service special agent with the Department of Homeland Security. When asked to comment by Mint Press, former FBI agent and whistleblower Colleen Rowley said she was not surprised at all to see FBI agents now working for the very tech companies. The agency policies stating that there now exists a revolving door between the FBI and the areas they are trying to regulate. This created a serious conflict of interest in her mind, as many agents have one eye on post-retirement jobs. She said, the truth is that at the FBI, 50% of all normal conversations that people had were about how you were going to make your money after retirement. Many former FBI officials hold influential roles within Twitter. For instance, in 2020, Matthew W. left a 15-year career as an intelligence program manager at the FBI to take up the post of senior director of product trust at Twitter. Patrick G., a 23-year FBI supervisory special agent, is now head of corporate security. And Twitter's director of insider risk and security investigations, Bruce A., was headhunted from his role as a supervisory special agent at the Bureau. His resume notes that at the FBI, he held various intelligence and law enforcement roles in the US, Africa, Europe, and Middle East, and was a human intelligence and counterintelligence regional specialist. On employment sites such as LinkedIn, many users choose not to reveal their full names. Meanwhile, between 2007 and 2021, Jeff Carlton built up a distinguished career in the United States Marine Corps, rising to become a senior intelligence analyst. Between 2014 and 2017, his LinkedIn profile notes he worked for both the CIA and FBI, authored dozens of official reports, some of which were read by President Barack Obama. Carlton describes his role as a problem solver and claims to have worked in many dynamic, high-pressure environments such as Iraq and Korea. In May 2021, he left official service to become a senior program manager at Twitter, responsible for dealing with the company's highest-profile trust and safety escalations. Other former FBI staff are employed by Twitter, such as Cheryl Vai as a policy domain specialist and Laura D as a senior analyst in global risk intelligence. Many of those listed were active in the FBI's public outreach programs, a practice sold as a community trust-building initiative. According to Rowley, however, these also function as ways for officials to meet the important people that would give them jobs after retirement. It basically inserts a huge conflict of interest, she told me in press, adding, "It warps and perverts the criminal investigative work that agents do when they're still working as agents because they anticipate getting lucrative jobs after retiring or leaving the FBI." Twitter certainly has endorsed the FBI as a credible actor, allowing the organization to play a part in regulating the global dissemination of information on its platform. In September 2020, it put out a statement thanking the federal agency. "We wish to express our gratitude to the FBI's Foreign Influence Task Force for their close collaboration and continued support of our work to protect the public conversation on this critical time," the statement read. 1 month later, the company announced that the FBI was feeding its intelligence and that it was complying with the request for deletion of accounts. In 2019, Twitter also hired Greg Anderson straight from NATO to work on cybercrime policy. This is a sparse information on what Anderson did at NATO, but alarmingly, his own LinkedIn profile stated simply that he worked on psychological operations for the military alliance. After Mint Press highlighted this fact in an article in April, he removed all mention of psychological operations from his profile, claiming now to have merely worked as a NATO researcher. Anderson left Twitter in the summer of last year to work as a product policy manager for the popular video platform TikTok. Twitter also directly employs active army officers. In 2019, Gordon McMillan, the head of the editorial for the entire Europe, West Asia region, and Africa region, was revealed to be an officer in the British Army's notorious 77th Brigade, a unit dedicated to online warfare and psychological operations. This bombshell news was steadfastly ignored across the media. With nearly 400 million global users, there is no doubt that Twitter has grown to become a platform large and influential enough to necessitate extensive security measures as actors of all stripes attempt to use the service to influence public opinion and political actions. There is also no doubt that there is a limited pool of people qualified in these sorts of fields. But recruiting largely from the U.S. national security state fundamentally undermines claims Twitter makes about its neutrality. The U.S. government is the source of some of the largest and most extensive influence operations in the world. As far back as 2011, The Guardian reported on the existence of a massive worldwide U.S. military online influence campaign in which it had designed software that allowed its personnel to secretly manipulate social media sites by using fake online persons to influence internet conversations and spread pro-American propaganda. The program boasts that the background of these personas is so convincing that psychological operation soldiers can be sure to work without fear of being discovered by sophisticated adversaries. Yet Twitter appears to be recruiting from the source of the problem. These former national security state officials are not being employed in politically neutral departments such as sales or customer service, but in security, trust, and content, meaning that some hold considerable sway over what messages and information are promoted and what is suppressed, demoted, or deleted.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
To the southeast of the Prophet's Mosque in Medina exists a cemetery that is the most famous and holiest in the Islamic world, Jannatul Baqi, meaning the Garden of Heaven. After the dawn prayers, the gates of Baqi are opened for a few hours, and crowds of Muslim pilgrims flock to it. Baqi is the main burial ground for the people of Medina since the time of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and contains graves of many of the Prophet Muhammad's family and companions.
In order to describe the importance of Baqi Cemetery, I have to say it is a rendezvous of thousands of Muslims every day.
Baqi is honored to host the tombs of four infallible Imams, Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba, Imam Ali Zain al-Abidin, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, peace be upon them. Today, there is no trace of the shrine that used to contain their tombs. Close to the graves are the remains of the House of Sorrows, a place where the Prophet's daughter, Lady Fatima, used to come to and shed tears of grief over the loss of her father.
When you enter in Mazari Baqiya, when you enter Mazari Baqiya, there you become very, you know, emotional.
It is also believed that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, often prayed in Baqi whenever he was passing through.
Baqi is like no other cemetery in the world of Islam. It's a place of absolute sanctity for all Muslims. Therefore, Hajj pilgrims every year visit this place to pay tribute to the relatives and companions of the Holy Prophet. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
It takes an in-person visit to Iran by the EU foreign policy chief now to revitalize the ailing 2015 deal between Iran and world powers. Josep Borrell said his two-day trip to Tehran is aimed at removing the last remaining roadblocks to concluding the Vienna talks, which have been at a stalemate since March this year.
My visit has one main objective. It was to break the current dynamic of escalation and to break the stalemate of the negotiations on the JCPOA.
The talks in Vienna began in April last year with the aim of returning the United States to the 2015 deal and ensuring Tehran's full compliance with its commitments. The negotiations have been stalled since March amid differences between Tehran and Washington. Iran says the United States, which is not